This is day two of the Freedom Day Retreat 2017. It's wonderful on this particular retreat to have a number of couples practicing here. Coupledom, or whatever it's called, couplehood, is quite an interesting feature of practice. Some people practice on their own, and both they and their partner are thrilled. Partner's thrilled because she's got the house to herself for a whole week, and you're thrilled to be able to sort of quietly put your pens and underpants where you like to. Other people like to practice together. That's wonderful. It's an interesting feature of practice, and Margie and I practice together. It's one of the, for me, one of the wonderful things of this life I've been dipped into. And there are a number of you that are doing that, and that's it's always inspiring to see how people take care of each other. But it has its own little pitfalls, which are interesting too. Sometimes you just don't need somebody's attention. Sometimes you need space. How do you balance the space and the need for solitude sometimes with the attentiveness, and so it goes on. But it is a quite dynamic piece of practice that continues when the last bell goes at night. And of course some people would love the opportunity to practice with someone else, and it just isn't part of their life, or not at this time. And so in a sense we come together as a sangha, as a practicing community, and support each other in that kind of way, which is often one of the most touching parts of our practice. This is not what we call a young retreat. Yes, it's a mature retreat. This is a mature retreat. Mainly because the Whale Girls and Osler Girls aren't here. What Margie calls the Barbie Sattvas. Anyway, that's neither here nor there, which is what most of my talks are about. I was thinking, just watching people look after each other, whether they're as a partner, as part of a couple, or outside of that, and the koan we were reading about the Bodhisattva of compassion. How does she use her 84,000 hands and eyes? Okay. It's a wonderful koan. And I started thinking about it, and thinking about it, and I sort of ground to a halt very quickly. And I decided that talking about compassion for half an hour is going to make everybody ill. So I'm going to talk about suffering instead. Much more interesting. I was recently, somebody sent me a very articulate piece about sort of compassion and a call to action by a woman who some of you may know personally or professionally, Dr. Pinkola Estes, I think. Anyway, Dr. Pinkola is one of these super articulate people. I've had some great Pinkola Estes enthusiasts around me at various times of my life, and I've had to sit through many hours of talk. And she has this astonishing ability to speak for 2 hours without saying or hesitating once. That's what I remember about her. I don't remember what she said. But I thought that's an astonishing facility. Anyway, somebody sent me this sort of call to action, which was full of this sort of Jungian, mythological, everything was tied up neatly and so on. And I think, at a point where someone had been writing to me about how difficult life is and so on, and I was sort of moved by this call to action. I thought, wonderful. Everybody must take the problems of their time and kind of stand up and be counted and so on. She has wonderful phrases. But despair, I do not let despair at my... I do not keep a place for despair at my table. Things like that. I thought, fantastic. I send it off to Zen Master Dega. We sort of correspond with little things like that. And he writes back, says, sounds like onward Christian soldiers. I read it again, and that's exactly what it sounded like. And I thought, oh goodness, yeah, okay. I didn't spot that one. But somehow I'm not meaning this as an attack on the author of that piece, because I mean, it's astonishingly articulate and really quite rousing, but there's something about the language is almost so complete that it lacks a believable rough edge. It's so neat that I can't find a way into it. And that happens a lot in this life. Sometimes we try and round things off so much that it hardly allows anybody else in. So somehow, I think that was the connection, how I got to talking about suffering, that somehow the rough edges themselves were where our lives are alive, or to catch light somehow. And, okay, here's the suffering part. Not that anyone needs to be reminded of it. That's why you're here. We know how suffering feels. We know how those rough edges feel. We know how we resist. We know how we try and fix them, including coming to a Zen retreat. That's the pattern. And of course, the word suffering, as used in the Buddhist tradition, of course, it's like word number one in the Buddhist dictionary. Begins with S, goes through to A. No, R. Suffering, first noble truth. But when I contacted Buddhism sometime in early 1970s, I met with a group of Tibetans who just was presented me with an astonishingly different kind of way of life than I'd encountered up to then. They had an astonishing ability to combine levity, laughter, playfulness with sitting like a mountain and being absolutely centered. And for me, that was just an astonishing thing. It was, and I had a feeling I wanted to investigate that in my own life, that it seemed so astonishing to me. Only later did I start to read Buddhist books. I went to a bookshop in somewhere in London and bought a book, and that was the first sentence, "Life is suffering." And it seemed to me quite a different tradition. I thought, well, what's going on here? But I think now, in my relative maturity, I can see the place of suffering in my own life, and maybe that's just made me more sensitive to it. And the term includes everything from sort of existential agony to frustration at a meal, frustration at anything, sense of alienation, sense of being caught in judgment, in irritation, in resentment, in justification of one's own ideas about things. So it's the whole range of what we'd think of as some kind of negative human experience. But what's interesting to me, so we know this in our lives. We know this to be something that's part of us, and we know together with that our dislike of it and our anxiety and urgency for finding a way around it. But when we begin to practice, we see that trying to find a way around it or escape it is part of the very pattern that is causing it in the first place. And that we can't pull ourselves up with our bootstraps. It just doesn't happen. And we find that out, and we don't like that either. So the circle kind of tightens around us. This is how it seems to me. This is my thinking about it. We function. Buddhists talk of the self and suffering together, and attachment. Attachment, suffering, and self go together. I think it's really important we don't see the self as a thing or an object, but rather as a mode of functioning in our lives. When we function in a continually self-referring way, there's a discomfort associated with that we term suffering. And in the Zen or Buddhist analysis of that, that function is carried primarily by a certain kind of thinking and a certain kind of emoting, affectiveness, what's the word? A feeling, it's called a feeling. Certain kind of thinking and feeling. The kind of feeling that's always referring to oneself, that's sort of justifying oneself, that is fearful for oneself, that is anxious, fueled by emotion, because they belong together, and the traditional word shin in Chinese, Japanese, is referring to heart, what we call heart and mind, that whole part of our functioning. That goes together with suffering. We call it the suffering self. It's the self that creates, as it were, the suffering, and the self that is created in the suffering. But it's a certain functioning of ourself. And when we are tied in that, the discomfort is part of it. We also know in our lives that when we are not functioning in that way, our thinking and feeling are very clear. And there's a spaciousness in them. So it's almost as if in our life we have, let's say, the suffering self-function, this continual self-referring anxious function, and within the same being there's also the when that suffering self is dropped, what appears to be left is the self that functions openly, spaciously, clearly and kindly. That appears to be the general pattern. If we go back, yes, let me carry on from there. The we come to practice because we suffer, because whether it's some direct pain, anxiety, fearfulness, regret, resentment, whether it's just a sort of inchoate sense of this is not enough, there's more, there's a smell of flowers on the wind. So we come to practice with that. And then we want to get from the suffering self-function into, let's call it the enlightened self, the open self. True self, they call it. Buddha nature, whatever. And we want to get there from here. But by definition, the self that's trying to escape suffering and fix the problem has to be absent to experience the open self, this open world. You can't get there from here. There's no stairway to heaven. However much Eric Clapton sings it. Great song, too. But we can't get there from here. The wanting to control it, the wanting to succeed, the wanting to get out of pain, the wanting to fix it, the wanting to be enlightened, is all part of the functioning, the suffering self. And the place we want to get to can only appear if we are not. So intellectually, there's a kind of great wall. That great big wall at the in that Game of Thrones. There's a movie series called The Game of Thrones, and there's a big wall at the end of the world. Anyway, sorry, you don't need to, don't have to tell me. There's a fundamental divide there. And I would suggest that that's one of the reasons that ensures the depth of this practice. We can't manipulate it, we can't control it, we can't escape, we can't get ourselves there. Because it's the very ourself that has to disappear before there appears. So we try, we hit ourselves against this pane of glass. We can't understand why we can't get clear or can't get happy or whatever we say to ourselves. Can't get relief or can't get comfort or can't get enlightenment. We beat ourselves against this glass. We don't understand why we keep on hitting our heads because we can't see the glass. And all of a sudden we stop, we give up. We just take a big breath. And all of a sudden, whatever we were heading for is all around us. We use the word grace. We use whatever words will point. But mostly we just are astonished and filled with gratitude. So in our practice, we come here deeply touched by the suffering of our lives and the suffering of others. And we come here, in a sense, to do something about it. And we till the ground, and we sit still, and we pay attention, and we give ourselves to the silence and the schedule. And that's as much as we can do. We can't control it, expect it, demand it. There's nothing to which we're entitled. We just keep finding here that we just put our feet forward into the space without knowing quite where we're treading. And without any expectation. And just that openness and humility and lack of self insistence is already part of the loosening of this function of self-referring life. And already in that, if it's genuine and heartfelt and just full of love and earnestness, already there appears a spaciousness, an affection, a relief, a grace, a blessing. And it's in that way that we hear a story like the koan that says, the figure of compassion, how does she use all her hands and eyes? It's as natural as reaching behind you in your half sleep in the dark, groping for the pillow behind you. So, thank you very much. Just sit a bit.